Good evening, everyone, and hello. You're listening to Revision Media at revisionmedia.org. Today is July 17, 2019. I'm your host, Richard Carey, and this is Arcane Semantics. A show trial. It's a noun, especially used to describe a totalitarian state court trial. The public trial of a political offender conducted chiefly for propagandistic purposes, as to suppress further dissent against the government by making an example of the accused. Show trial is exactly what is being used to describe the Sandy Hook court case, which has been progressing clearly for propagandistic purposes here. I mean, this is all about the public perception through manipulating that soundbite, that headline, which can be retracted later on page 147, right after the classifieds or some such, which no one will notice as much, but basically trying to discredit, regardless of how much you may be slandering individuals in the proceeds. And a lot of this is routine trickery used by the corporate media, the powers that be, working in conjunction with the government. We have Dr. James Fetzer, who's been at the center of this show trial. Carl Herman had an interesting article on the case, published July 12th. Dr. Jim Fetzer's debrief on Sandy Hook show trial. Orwellian quote-unquote judge violates right to jury to determine disputed facts, claims five versions of the death certificate equal no differences, and silences two expert witnesses proving multiple areas of forgery. Trial by jury, verdict in civil cases, section 5, the right of trial by jury shall remain inviolate and shall extend to all cases at law without regard to the amount in controversy, but a jury trial may be waived by the parties in all cases in the manner prescribed by law. That's from the Wisconsin State Constitution. Free speech, libel, section 3. Every person may freely speak, write, and publish his sentiments on all subjects, being responsible for the abuse of that right, and no laws shall be passed to restrain or abridge the liberty of speech or of the press. In all criminal prosecutions or indictments for libel, the truth may be given in evidence, and if it shall appear to the jury, for that matter, charged as libelous, be true, as and was published with good motives and for justifiable ends, the party shall be acquitted, and the jury shall have the right to determine the law and the fact. That's the Wisconsin State Constitution quoted as well. But without further ado...
Those are very well said. Very well said, Richard. This is Jim Fetzer here. I'm very pleased to join you. I thought Carl Herman did a brilliant job with it. You may have seen Paul Craig Roberts' subsequent article about the case where, you know, I was really... blindsided on this. The judge made a series of rulings that essentially deprived me of my right to present a defense to explain the context within which this death certificate had been fabricated, and in addition would not allow the direct evidence that I had amassed, including the reports of two forensic document examiners who not only concluded that the death certificate that I had described in the book as a fabrication was a fabrication, but that three other death certificates, including the one attached to the complaint, which was falsely claimed to differ in no material respect from the death certificate that I had described in the book as a fabrication, when the one attached to the complaint had both the town registrar certification, the state certification, a file number, none of which were present on the death certificate that I had described. It had no file number, no state certification, no town certification, which in and of itself showed that it was a fabrication, because in Connecticut, not even parents are allowed to have the possession of an unregistered, a non-registered, a non-certified death certificate. It had to have the town registrar certification. And two other death certificates, one of which Dave Gaheri, the business manager for Moonrock Books, had obtained directly from Debbie Aurelia Halstead, who was a registrar for Newtown, which was very odd because it had a partial printed file number, only three digits of which could be discerned, 2, 4, 3, which did not correspond to the digits of the handwritten file number, and a fourth, which I obtained directly from the state, from the Department of Public Health of the state of Connecticut, along with four other death certificates. They concluded that all four of those death certificates were fabrications. And would you believe the judge dismissed their reports as just opinions, as though all opinions were on a par, and just bulldozed my evidence to the side to create a primrose path for the plaintiff's attorney, which I even described as a yellow brick road. Get this, Richard. They were debating whether Mike Palachek, my co-defendant, and I would even be allowed to speak during the trial for damages scheduled for October, whether we'd be allowed to speak and talk about the context within which this took place before I had been allowed to make my statement during the oral hearing. This was completely outrageous. And for those who are unaware, summary judgments are bound by the requirement that a judge is only allowed to make the determination if there are no disputed facts in the case. But clearly, the authenticity of the death certificate, which was a central issue at stake, was massively disputed. The judge went ahead and ruled that there were no disputed facts in spite of my protest to the contrary, in spite of all the evidence that supported me and not the plaintiff, and ruled in favor of the plaintiff. And now I face $1 million in punitive damages over a death certificate that I'd never before seen or ever commented upon, namely the one that was attached to the death certificate, which they falsely maintain did not differ in any material respects from the one I had described accurately in the book as a fabrication. That's the state of justice in Wisconsin today.
And you're being accused as having done this with malice. I forget the word they used exactly, but that's where something like these death certificates discrepancies would be particularly important, and evidence which must be admitted, because that would show, you know, whether or not you knew it was, something you were slanderously, maliciously attacking with, or whether you thought this was factual.
You're 100% correct, and right in the book. And by the way, everyone in your audience can download the first edition of the book, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, for free. It went on sale on 22 October 2015, had sold nearly 500 copies in less than a month when it was banned on 19 November. I knew it was political. Amazon at the time had 20 books on Sandy Hook, 19 of which agreed with the official position, only one of which disagreed. That one, however, had 13 contributors, including 6 current or retired PhD professors. We established the school had been closed by 2008, that it was loaded with asbestos and other biohazards, damaged by hurricanes, that it was even a severe flood in the area in 2007. There were no students there. That it was a two-day FEMA exercise that was presented as mass murder in order to promote gun control. Indeed, another of our contributors, Paul Preston, not a PhD, but a school administrator who supervised drills in the past, was so disturbed by what he saw broadcast from Newtown that day that he reached out to his contacts in the Obama Department of Education, all of whom confirmed to him that it had been a drill, that no students had died, and that it was done to promote gun control. Our evidence is that massive and conclusive. And the events on the ground confirmed that it had been a FEMA exercise, a mass casualty exercise involving children, for which we even have found the manual, which I included as Appendix A. Among the evidence on the ground that confirmed it was a FEMA exercise, there was a portable sign that said everyone must check in. You're not going to find that at any crime scene, a sign that says everyone must check in. But it said right in the FEMA manual, everyone must check in with a controller upon arrival. You'll find porta-potties, pizza and bottled water at the firehouse. Well, you're not going to find porta-potties, pizza and bottled water at a crime scene. But if they're standard parts of FEMA exercises, they provide restrooms and refreshments. You're going to find many people with name tags on lanyards. That's exactly how FEMA identifies her players, by color-coded name tags on lanyards. Again, something you're not going to see at a real bona fide crime scene. There were parents bringing their children to the scene. Well, no parent's going to bring their child to the scene of a child shooting massacre. I mean, this is all absurdity. Not only that, but on the day of the alleged shooting, there was no surge of EMTs into the building. There was no string of ambulances to rush their little bodies off to hospitals where they could be pronounced dead or alive. No medevac helicopter was called. They put up triage tarps, but no bodies, dead or alive, were ever placed upon them. And when the medical examiner the following day held a press conference, he explained that they had not allowed the parents to see the children, but had only identified them as photographs. Since we published the book, we've discovered why that was the case. These children only existed in the form of photographs. They were fictions that were created out of photographs of older children when they were younger. Mona Alexis Presley, who's done brilliant work in this area, has even concluded some of the parents used photographs of themselves when they were younger. You might ask, why would anyone do this? Well, I believe there were political motives, that they thought they were do-gooders that were going to show the country what could happen if we don't take guns away from the people. But in addition, they were paid off handsomely. The best estimates we have are between $27 and $130 million was contributed by sympathetic but gullible Americans and the false belief these families had lost children at Sandy Hook. Divided evenly between the 26 fake families feigning having lost children or relatives among the teachers and so forth, that would turn out to be $1 million to $5 million for participating in elaborate hoax. It was a form of faux terrorism. It struck fear into the hearts of the American people, especially parents across the continent, all in order to make the public more amenable to manipulation to promote the Barack Obama gun control agenda. This was a despicable offense. And what happened in the courtroom when I was prepared to lay it all out in spades, the judge ruled out my offering a massive indirect evidence. I explained in my answer to the complaint that was served upon me, not with a motion to dismiss because I wanted to join issues. In fact, the process server said she'd never seen anyone so happy to receive a lawsuit as was I when she served me. And that's because I had this massive evidence I wanted to get into a judicial framework where it could be certified through the legal process for the American people to understand the magnitude of the deception. I explained in my answer that I would approach this with two different lines of argument. One was indirect or circumstantial. How we know that this was a FEMA exercise where no children died, which would mean necessarily that any death certificate for alleged decedents would have to be fabrications. And second of all, direct evidence about the death certificate, which was even laid out and published in the book, including that there was no file number, there was no form of certification, there was typographical differences between different fonts, different sizes. There was a texture problem where the bottom two-thirds was a darker texture, the top light. It looked to me as though it had been put together by combining the bottom half of a real death certificate with the top half of a fake. Some of my reasons for drawing those conclusions turned out to be wrong, but my conclusion that this was a fabrication was right. and it was vindicated by two forensic document examiners. Indeed, the second of the two, the first from Minnesota, a fellow by name of Larry Wickstrom, said it was mind-boggling to discover that the state of Connecticut was not only issuing fabricated death certificates, but that it was giving different fabricated death certificate to different parties in litigation. And the second, A.P. Robertson from California, whose credentials are even more imposing, not only backed up Wickstrom's finding that all four of the death certificates were fabrications, but did an analysis of the Social Security number for Noah Posner and discovered it too was fake. We'd already discovered that a passport image that Lenny Posner had put up on a blog, which was studied by Mona Alexis Presley, was itself a counterfeit. The photographic image of Noah was a snapshot rather than a formal photograph. He wasn't even looking at the camera. It was much too large in terms of the space allocated by the Department of State. You don't even require an expert to determine that that passport was a counterfeit. So we have fake death certificates. We have a fake Social Security card. We have a fake passport. And yet the judge ruled that there was no disputed issue here in favor of the plaintiff to find me guilty of defamation, basically based upon this death certificate from the state that they argued was in no material respect different than the one I described in the book, which was a logical absurdity from the beginning. If you want to find the state of justice in Wisconsin today in 2019, you couldn't have a better example. It is stunning.
And so I find a lot of the anomalies recently touched upon, such as in this blog by Carl Herman, where you mentioned the age of the mothers and the statistical relevance compared to other astronomically unlikely events. I don't know how much of that you would, want to go over verbatim, but I found it very compelling information just to show people who don't get just how much these claims, just from something like that alone, clearly, are fabricated. The school being in working order, these children and families existing, and the ages that they were.
That's right. What Carl was revealing was that the average age of the mother was 10 years older than the average across the country, which is 26. You had 20 Sandy Hook parents who averaged 36. And that is because they were faking the children using photographs that were 10 years out of date on the average. That's really what it reflects. Carl Herman, that was Carl Herman's brilliant statistical analysis. He's a nationally recognized school teacher. He does absolutely brilliant work. And I mean, the figure, the improbability of having these 20 mothers that, averaging 10 years or above the average across country for giving birth to their children is so improbable. He had to look it up in a dictionary to figure out how to even say the word. It was so astronomically improbable.
Right. Yes. Just to even say that number, just how large a number it was. He had to research that, and just how many other. I posted it in our live chat for the station right now. If anyone wants to look it up, though, it's carlbherman.blogspot.com. You can find it. Dr. Jim Fetzer's debrief on Sandy Hook show trial.
It's also on my blog. It's also on my blog, Richard. You can find it at jamesfetzer.org, jamesfetzer.org. And now there's a second brilliant piece by Paul Craig Roberts, whom I regard as our nation's leading public intellectual, that's been published internationally on The Truth Seeker out of the UK, for example, one of my favorite blogs. So a lot of people are understanding this was totally fraudulent. This was a total abuse of the judicial system. And I can't begin to tell you how disillusioning it was for me to sit there while this abuse of the judicial process was taking place right in front of my eyes. In fact, The plaintiff's attorney even introduced a fifth fabricated death certificate during the oral hearing. It was completely outrageous. He didn't show it to me, even though I was the defendant, and he was obligated to show it to me before he shared it with the judge. He claimed that this was the death certificate that that Lenny Posner, the plaintiff, had obtained from the registrar, Debbie Aurelia, that he had posted on the website, which is just plain false. He was talking as though Lenny Posner hadn't directed Kelly Watt to where to find this death certificate, which had no form of certification, which had no file number. I mean, he was playing games. This attorney was saying things that were blatantly untrue. He was implying we would just had been, you know, scouring the internet and that we'd come upon this death certificate by chance. When Lenny Posner had actually reached out to Kelly Watt, he had talked to her over 100 hours during a six-month period of time. She told him over and over she didn't believe a word he said. She thought he was a liar, thought he didn't have a son, didn't have a son who died. Asked for proof. She wanted to see a death certificate. She wanted to see a birth certificate. She wanted to see a kindergarten card. She wanted to see a photograph of Noah in the hospital with his mother. And he put up some of that where Kelly was, when he directed Kelly where to find it, she was immediately suspicious because the kindergarten report card had the name of the street on which the school is located misspelled. It's Dickinson, D-I-C-K-I-N-S-O-N, but on the report card, the kindergarten card, it said Dickinson, D-I-C-K-E-N-S-O-N, which obviously was a telling sign that this is a forgery. And she obtained the death certificate, yes, from the internet, but at a specific direction. The attorney for the plaintiff also said we were dealing with copies of copies of copies, as though digital technology doesn't give you an exact reproduction every single time. I'm convinced he was in violation of the code of ethics for attorneys, and this is not the end of the story with regard to his performance, his abuse of his position in the courtroom on that occasion. It's outrageous.
Well, as far as these multiple death certificates, five including the one the judge introduced, your point on that is the jury should have a right to have that entered admissible as evidence and for them to make the decision, not the judge to decide that it's inadmissible. That's completely a violation of your right to jury on that point, is what you say. Is that correct?
Yep. That's 100% correct, Richard, and that's why I appreciated your reading those quotes with which Carl Herman begins his article, because they're absolutely crucial. I was denied my due process. I was denied the right to put up a defense. I was denied the right to a jury trial. The proscription for a summary judgment is very specific, that the judge may not render a determination unless there are no disputed findings of fact. But we were disputing over 100 of the claims to fact made by the plaintiff. The judge just shoved all that to one side and pretended it didn't even exist. It was as shocking a display of the abuse of judicial authority as I could imagine, and that it was happening to me in front of my very eyes was profoundly affecting, unbelievably disillusioning. Here I was seeing the American judicial process corrupted by politics in front of my very eyes.
And you're a former Marine, a university professor. I mean, you're a member of the community who should be given a great deal of respect, at the very least have the rights that any citizen has the right to. And it's just ridiculous how they're trying to make an example of individuals such as yourself in this case. This is a landmark case, though, right? This will set a precedent regarding questioning a lot of shootings staged events that we dissect, that we question.
If this case were allowed to stand, if it's not reversed, and I have now submitted an application for an appellate court review, where if they accept my application, they will review this case from beginning to end. They're going to shake it out. It's going to be a stunning reversal here. And I believe that the case that we laid out in the application for appellate review is very powerful, very convincing, and demonstrates one abuse after another that this was a completely improper verdict and that it must be reviewed and reversed, and I must have the opportunity to take my case to the jury. You're making key points, Richard. Yes, I was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the U.S. Marine Corps upon graduation from Princeton. I graduated magna cum laude in philosophy when Princeton was number one in the world in math, physics, and philosophy at the time. I served 4 years in the Marine Corps. I resigned my commission as a captain to enter graduate school in the history and the philosophy of science at Indiana University. I had earned my PhD in 1970, began with my first academic appointment at the University of Kentucky. I would subsequently serve at a wide range of institutions of higher learning, including the University of Virginia twice, the University of Cincinnati, North Carolina at Chapel Hill, New College of the University of South Florida. I did a year's study of computer science and artificial intelligence before I was hired as full professor with tenure on the Duluth campus of the University of Minnesota. At the time, I had published just 3 books in my first few years at Minnesota. I published 16, 17 more. I have 24 academic books now and over a dozen in the area of conspiracy research. In 1996, I was selected to be among the first 10 to be honored with a new rank created by the University of Minnesota, the Distinguished McKnight University Professor, which came with a $100,000 research grant for faculty who were in their early years as full professors who'd made particularly distinguished contributions that enhanced the reputation of the University of Minnesota while they were on the faculty at the University of Minnesota. So that when I concluded my career in 2006 after a 35-year career, I became a Distinguished McKnight University Professor Emeritus, a rank I enjoy to this day. I've done a vast amount of research in the area of conspiracy. I have done research on JFK. I have 4 published books on JFK. All of this, by the way, is collaborative, where I bring together the best experts on different aspects of these cases. 4 books on JFK, 2 books on 9/11. I have a book on the moon landing and other issues. I have a book on Sandy Hook, the Boston bombing, Orlando and Dallas, Parkland, Charlottesville. It's stunning how much the American people have been played. And in fact, Amazon.com has just banned 5 more books from moonrockbooks.com. So if you want to know what's happening, each of these books I bring together between 12 and 15 experts, the leading experts on each of these cases, so that you're not just getting my opinion, you're getting the research results of a dozen to 15 other experts. And you can find it all there in these books at moonrockbooks.com. But where Amazon has now banned 6 of the 12 books we have there, I mean, this has to be unprecedented in the history of American publication. It's like the book burning days of the Third Reich. It's completely shocking, Richard. And I encourage everyone, if they don't want to miss the opportunity to learn the truth about these events and how seriously the American public has been played, you want to go to moonrockbooks.com and check them out.
It is unprecedented. From what I understand, even in the Third Reich, after the initial burnings, the average German citizen still had enough freedoms to access anything out there that he wished. There was, I know, a lot of degeneracy, and, well, yeah, Hitler took a very extreme approach. I caught your broadcast earlier today. You touched on a lot of excellent information from Iran to everything going on with the Seth Rich case, and also, well, yeah, you even touched on the Holocaust, for that matter. Just some of the censorship we're dealing with more and more in this current Orwellian age. It's just amazing how much this is turning into a Soviet Union style of censorship and oppression. And, you know, this is just in my lifetime. I was born in the bicentennial in 76, so I'm 42. And just in my lifetime alone, this country has completely seemed like it did a 180. I hear about some corruption already that had led up to the 70s there, you know, preceded it, but it's only gotten worse. I mean, the Federal Reserve was just the start.
The comparison with the Soviet Union is very apt, Richard, because they had show trials, which were done as forms of political theater. Most certainly, that's what happened here in Dane County, very near my residence, where I live in a small village just south of Madison. I mean, it was stunning to me to find that this had been an orchestrated event and that I had not got anything remotely like a fair shake, that I'd been deprived of my most fundamental rights of due process. The entire case was what's technically known as abuse of process, meaning that the although it was allegedly a defamation case, the real purpose was to punish those of us who are skeptics about Sandy Hook, who's been speaking out, publishing, giving lectures, giving interviews, making videos to reveal what actually happened, which, as you can already sense from what I've sketched already, it was a FEMA drill presented as mass murder to promote gun control. Has to be one of the most horrific actions ever undertaken by an American administration on the American people. And it was done by Barack Obama, Joe Biden, Eric Holder, Governor Daniel Malloy, the Connecticut State Police, who were running the scene behind the FEMA exercise, and all the participants, the Newtown School Board, which got $50 million for a new kindergarten through fourth grade school. I looked into the matter at the time. It turns out across country, the average cost for a kindergarten through fourth grade school is $7 million. But the Newtown School Board got a grant of $50 million, seven times $7 million. You got to ask yourself, what in the world is going on here? This was totally fraudulent. And Barack Obama and Joe Biden and Eric Holder were all profoundly involved. There's no escaping the conclusion. The evidence is overwhelming. Barack Obama even nullified the Smith-Mundt Act of 1948, which precluded the use of the same techniques of propaganda and disinformation within the United States that had been used without by the Smith-Mundt Modernization Act of 2012, just in time for Sandy Hook. Essentially, Obama legitimated phony, deceptive actions like this as propaganda exercises by the American government on the American people. He made it legal to do that. And look how we've been overwhelmed by one after another ever since.
There's just so much evidence as far as the official story not being true. The amount of evidence you've documented on the condition of the building, the school building at the time, how run down it was and completely unable to be functional. And I understand that the actual, parents in the community had relocated en masse afterwards. So many of them, their mortgages had been paid off, which was very odd. But even the mortuary and the reportings of the deaths that year, I mean, you'd think if they were going to pull off a hoax well, they would have at least logged those in properly. But no, right? They weren't.
Well, Richard, this was the first of these complete scams, the first of these domestic hoaxes, and they just didn't have it down pat yet. That's why they had to rig this trial in such an extensive way to suppress my right to give evidence in my favor. They disallowed my explaining the context within which the fabrication of a child's death certificate made sense and could be understood and explained, to allow the plaintiff the opportunity to make it look as though we had just somehow lost our way, when we in fact were being very methodical and systematic in dissecting what had actually happened on 14 December 2012. Let me give you an illustration. One of the contributors to the book, Dr. Eowyn, who maintains the Fellowship of the Mind's blog, which I highly recommend, had already published 80 articles about Sandy Hook before I edited the book. I myself had published 30 articles. So I took the best of the best and put them together in the book, Nobody died at Sandy Hook, and I repeat, take advantage of the opportunity to download that book for free to your desktop, because you can do it now. But Leonard Posner, based upon this completely unjustified decision by the court, is using that as a pretext to demand that people who have archived the book for free for public release to take it down. So he's going to continue his efforts. He's trying to parlay this pseudo victory, this fake victory in court, into a scheme for suppressing all Sandy Hook research, which of course was the whole idea behind the entire scheme of bringing this completely ridiculous lawsuit against me from the beginning. I mean, unbelievable, Richard, what's going on here. And the judge was, I think, properly described as a willing participant in this deception. It's really shocking.
It really is, Dr. Fetzer. And this, again, is going to try to set a precedent toward people being afraid to question any shootings that happened at a later date than this one, basically, and what could happen to them should they dare to.
Yes, yes. I mean, if they can take me down for crying out loud, when I'm a distinguished professor, I have 36-plus books published, I have hundreds of scholarly articles, I have many awards and distinctions for my scholarly research, who and a former Marine Corps officer, who can they not take down? This is embarrassingly bad, and it's a shame. It's a blot on the courts here in Wisconsin, and I intend to do everything I possibly can to straighten it out.
So what is the current status then, sir, as of what you have to look forward to next in court?
Well, we had this decision made on the motion for summary judgment. I have now submitted an application to the appellate court for what's technically known as an interlocutory appeal. That means, although the case isn't formally resolved because damages will only be decided during a jury trial that is set for October, where, as I mentioned before, the plaintiff's attorney and the judge were discussing whether Mike Palachek, my co-defendant, and I would even be allowed to speak. I mean, it's that obscene, where because a great deal of damage would take place if this isn't dealt with immediately by the appeals court. The appeal has been submitted to the court. It's been formally acknowledged that the appeal has been submitted to the court. Normally, the court will decide whether or not to accept an application for a review within 7 to 10 days. So we'll learn very promptly whether the appellate court will review the case. If they review the case, I have no doubt they're going to find all of these anomalies, improprieties, judicial abuses, that it's all going to come tumbling out. So I'm hoping that that is where we will get a modicum of justice and the situation will be reversed and I'll have the opportunity to take my case to the jury. Because I have excellent witnesses, I have abundant evidence to prove that there was no defamation here. On the contrary, the whole case was itself as fabricated as a death certificate.
Well, I look forward to hearing the results of that. I would like to see things at least finally come out enough where this cannot continue, the injustice toward your right to a fair trial by jury. And are there other individuals involved that are being prosecuted in the same case as yours, or is it completely separate?
Well, there were three co-defendants originally. There was Mike Palachek, who is the series editor, in relation to the book. He suggested the book's title and wrote the preface, but I, as the book editor, brought together all the contributions. I organized the contents. I positioned all the images, structured the book, created the index and everything else about it. And then we have the publisher. This book was originally published by CreateSpace, which is a subsidiary of Amazon.com, which makes it all the more absurd that when on the 19th of November they declared that the book was in violation of their policies without being more specific, and they would no longer carry it. It was obvious to me this was political, and why I released it immediately to the public for free as a PDF. A friend who follows these matters has calculated that the book has been downloaded for free as many as 10 million times. Now, I think that's sensational, because I was never in this for the sake of money, but rather to get the truth out. And now the whole world can download the book for free. Again, I say, just put in the title in a browser, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook. And you should find various options for downloading it directly to your desktop. But bear in mind, this guy who calls himself Lenny Posner, and frankly, I do not believe that's his real name. I made that point to the court again and again and again. But it was like water off a duck's back. The court was non-responsive. It appears to me that Noah Posner is a fiction that was made up out of photographs of his older stepbrother, Michael Vabner, when he was a child. And we have so many photographs that show what's supposed to be Lenny Posner with Noah, that when Noah turns out to be Michael Vabner, that creates a presumption that since this person stood in a familial relationship to the child, if the child is Michael Vabner, it's reasonable to infer the father is Reuben Vabner, so that when the plaintiff sought a DNA study to show that they had a sample of DNA that was allegedly from the shooting to confirm that this was DNA of the child of Lenny Posner, the plaintiff, I protested that I didn't doubt they could have a sample of DNA because they could get it from Michael Vabner, who actually is, by my account, the biological son of the plaintiff, who is perpetrating a fraud on the court by not even using his real name in a legal proceeding. Indeed, Dr. Elwin, whom I mentioned before, has done national searches doing two search engines and cannot turn up a person by the name of Leonard Posner anywhere in the United States. When I confronted him with this during a video deposition here in Madison, he said that was because he had opted out. But how can you opt out of a national search? It would make these searches completely worthless. So he was perpetrating another fraud during his oral deposition. In fact, I discovered multiple instances where he was making false statements under oath. So, you know, the situation, the deeper you dig, the worse it gets for the plaintiff. I actually proposed, when they wanted to do the DNA study, to expand it to include not only Noah Posner and Lenny Posner, but Michael Vabner and Reuben Vabner and Veronique De La Rosa, the purported mother. But the judge did not approve. He wouldn't allow my motion. I mean, he was cutting me off at every opportunity to elicit relevant evidence about what was taking place here. It was, in retrospect, I see very clearly how the judge was cutting off one avenue of my defense after another systematically as we proceed toward this ill-fated summary judgment hearing, oral hearing on summary judgment, which was so obviously and blatantly improperly decided.
And just how much those children were fabricated, completely fabricated, did not exist. And we have a great deal of procedures. I believe Wolfgang Halbig had been an inspector of school districts and how they're supposed to behave and operate in such crises, situations of various types, for that matter. And I believe he documented a large amount of ways that procedure was completely opposite what should be the case for a large number of the emergency individual operatives.
I'm a huge fan of Wolfgang Halbig. He's a former Florida State Trooper. He's a former U.S. Customs Agent. He's a former school principal. He's a nationally recognized school safety expert. He and I traveled to Newtown together in 2014. He sought to enter the United Way for Northeast Connecticut, as I recall. And even though by law their records are supposed to be publicly accessible, 7 or 8 Newtown police officers physically created a barrier to prevent him from entering the facility to inspect their donation records. In addition, we visited the site where the school had been located, which was now reduced to dirt clods. You may or may not know, but everyone who was involved in the demolition of that building was required to take lifetime gag orders so that they could never talk about what they saw or did not see when they took down the building, which would have included no blood on the floor, no pockmarks in the wall. It would have been obvious that this was simply a decrepit building, that it had cracked walls, it had all kinds of moss, it was in deplorable condition, they were using it for storage. I mean, it goes on and on. In fact, it's fascinating. You can tell this whole thing was a hoax just from looking at an aerial photograph of the parking lot, Richard. It was a 38 ground temperature day, which isn't quite freezing, but it's certainly cold enough that you'd have to heat up the building if you're going to have students in school. But there's no heat or steam rising from the building, no doubt because the boilers were decrepit and non-functional since their non-use from 2008. In addition, there's no handicap parking. American for Disability Act requirements, both Connecticut and federal, dictate that to have a public facility legally operate, and they must have parking for the handicapped. The familiar blue and white parking and signage, there is none of that present at the Sandy Hook Elementary School, which means by law it could not have been legally operating as a school. It had exits and entrances, for example, that were not wheelchair accessible. One was a wooden staircase that no wheelchair could navigate, and there was even a piece of steel pipe extending that could pop the eye out of a little kid if he ran into it. No school principal would have allowed the school to be in such a deplorable condition, but it had been abandoned. It was simply being used for storage. Third, all the rows of vehicles in the center are parked facing the school, but that contradicts the driving instructions coming in off Dickinson Drive. You'd come in, you'd take a right, and then you'd curl around left and park facing away. But evidently, it was simply simpler to bring the cars in a single file and put them in 2x2x2 all facing the building. After all, they were only props. Who was even going to notice? So just from a photograph of the parking lot, you can discern that this was a hoax.
Wow. And then all of the things that were ordered in advance, as far as, well, even porta potties. I mean, that's a ridiculous example. All these porta potties that were there, just the amount of emergency vehicles. And you mentioned pizza, refreshments. I mean, it was just, from what is described by you, very much sounding more like a festival. Or like you say, a FEMA drill. You're familiar with the procedures there. And just completely not the way things would have gone down, the way people would have reacted. All of the staff, the teachers, even the parents as well, when they get on the scene, I think there's a lot of analyses of that. But all in all, this wasn't a functional school, and they had planned this far in advance.
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. I think this was planned years in advance. You mentioned a lot of the housing. They appear to have created a synthetic community that they brought parents in to feign having families and to have lost children, and they were given homes basically for free. And it was done. These transactions were shown on Christmas Eve, which is simply absurd. Any real estate agent will affirm no business is done on Christmas Eve. I mean, that is simply preposterous. But they were careless in the way they put it together. They never imagined the event would be subjected to the degree of scrutiny that it has sustained since this fake event took place on 14 December 2012.
And From what you say, the school hadn't been functional for at least about 4 years, for at least since about 2008.
Right. It was closed by 2008. That's exactly right. And, I mean, the proof is just extensive and overwhelming. This is why I encourage everyone to download the book for free while it's still possible to do so. This Leonard Posner, by the way, I have described him as a cyber terrorist. He has used an organization he calls Honor, H-O-N-R, but there's no honor associated with it, to defend Sandy Hook parents. What he's actually done is taking down research from the internet that's done by Sandy Hook skeptics, but he's now broadened to do conspiracy research in general so the American people can't have access to what we actually have discovered about these events. He has boasted in interviews of being responsible for removing tens of thousands of content items for the internet. Tens of thousands of content items from the internet. Where a video, a single YouTube video or a blog would constitute a content item. He has been responsible for taking down tens of thousands. It is outrageous.
Have the amount of people and the amount, even the independent media, have covered this and spoken to people like you have changed in the time since this has occurred? I mean, I know, had you in the past, I know even Alex Jones was covering it quite a while, some years ago. Does he still touch a topic like this? He seems like he's relatively safe with his material these days, even though I wouldn't trust, you know, him with the 10-foot pole. I mean, he seems to just be very much in line with the Trump administration's point of view on things now.
Richard, actually, it's something like the other way around. Alex never featured me about Sandy Hook. He did feature Wolfgang Halbig.
Okay.
When he did his... On 9/11, however, when he organized his American Scholars Conference in Los Angeles in 2006, this was at the end of June, he invited me to be the keynote speaker. I had founded Scholars for 9/11 Truth in December of 2005, and during 2006, we'd taken off like a rocket. We had a website where I managed the location of every item that went up on the website. We sponsored lectures. We posted videos. We published blogs and articles. It was a tremendous success. By the end of 2006, we had nearly 800 members in four different categories. Alex invited me to be the keynote speaker at his American Scholars Conference in Los Angeles in 2006. And when C-SPAN came on Sunday to video the panel discussion, the four participants of the panel were all members of Scholars. Stephen Jones, a professor of physics from BYU, whom I'd invited to be the co-chair of Scholars, was the first. The second was Bob Bauman, who had been a Korean War ace with 101 MiGs to his credit, but more importantly had a PhD in nuclear engineering from Caltech and been the scientific advisor on the Star Wars project to Presidents Reagan and Ford. Then there was Webster Tarpley, who published a spectacular book, 9/11 Synthetic Terror Made in the USA. And then me as the founder of Scholars, where I gave the top 10 reasons we know the hijackers are fake. It was an hour and 45 minutes, really quite spectacular, and C-SPAN would put it up seven or eight times later on during the year. And I believe it had the effect of shattering the glass ceiling about discussion, public discussion about 9/11, because we exposed so many ways in which you can tell that 9/11 was an inside job. So that was spectacular. Now, when Alex was sued about Sandy Hook, he did interviews with Megyn Kelly and other issues, but he wound up being on all sides. He had said definitively it was fake, no children were killed, but he'd also said definitively children were killed and it was real. So he was on all sides. I believe they targeted Alex Jones to be a fall guy, that he would deliberately take a fall, and then they could claim that, look, since Alex Jones was a Sandy Hook denier and he's taken a fall, Sandy Hook must be real. And also, since he's so prominent as a conspiracy theorist, that it shows that conspiracy theorists don't know what they're doing. When these lawsuits began coming to Alex Jones, I actually entered his case in Texas with an amicus curiae brief where I gave him evidence to prove that Noah Posner was in fact a fiction made up of photographs of Michael Vabner, his older stepbrother, as a child, which he could have used to exonerate himself, but he chose to not do that, which tells me he was part and parcel of the plan to take a fall, sad to say. I have long believed that Alex Jones was performing a valuable function for the public by stimulating interest in cases that were anomalous, that were puzzling, and he'd often invite discussion and speculation about the different possible explanations for what took place. He never actually carried forward from that point on, however, to look at the evidence systematically to sort out which are the best supported hypotheses among the alternatives, and finally, when the evidence settles down, which is the one you're entitled to accept in the tentative, infallible fashion of science, knowing that even though it's the best supported, it might still turn out to be false, and with the access or acquisition of new evidence and new hypotheses, you may have to reject hypotheses you previously accepted, accept hypotheses you previously rejected, and leave others in suspense. Alex was good on the first two stages of puzzlement and speculation, but he was hopelessly inept at adapting hypotheses to the evidence and sorting out the difference between those that are well-supported and those that were not. So it was a good place to start, but a bad place to finish. He could kick off a discussion, but you never really reached a terminal point where you understood what had happened.
Didn't he very early on at times focus on the dancing Israelis and even implicate Israel, but then shifted to only referring to Saudi Arabia later in reference to the 9/11
No, my impression, Richard, and I wasn't following Alex Jones at the time. I don't think I've ever actually watched a whole program of Alex Jones. I've seen a bits and pieces here and there, you know, particularly from, you know, clips that would show up on the internet rather than watching his whole show. But he's actually, in my opinion, been a Zionist stooge. He would never talk about Israel in relation to 9/11. In fact, that's also true of Judy Wood and her Do group. They won't talk about who is responsible or why and try to turn that into a virtue. It's also true of architects and engineers. They won't talk about who is responsible and why. In my book, that makes both architects and engineers and Judy Wood and her Do group limited hangouts. They want to talk about how it was done, but they don't have an adequate account of how it was done, and they refuse to talk about who was responsible and why in the absence of a narrative of which none of this business about how it was done is significant to the average American. If they understood the context, if they understood that Israel had plotted this event, that it was done with, say, a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes, that the whole idea was to draw the United States into endless wars in the Middle East to take out the modern Arab states that serve as a counterbalance to Israel's domination of the entire region and eventually to confront the Persian nation of Iran, then the American people might perk up their ears, open their eyes, and pay attention. But when you give a separate, independent talk about Building 7, where most Americans have no idea what in the world they're talking about, it becomes a pointless exercise in futility. That's why, you know, Scholars for 9/11 Truth has been the only organization that will talk about the who, the how, and the why, where I have two books about it. One was based on our first conference on the science and politics of 9/11 held here in Madison at the Radisson, which I published entitled The 9/11 Conspiracy, subtitled the 9/11, you know, Scamming the American Public. But the second is and that was from a major publisher in Chicago, open court under their Cat Feet Press imprint. But I published then with Moonrock Books, America Nuked on 9/11, Compliments of the CIA, the Neocons, and the Department of Defense of the Mossad. because we know the buildings were being blown apart from the top down. They were being converted into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust, which, by the way, is a signature of the use of nuclear devices to convert material into very fine particles. And when it was done, there was nothing in their footprint. Contrast that with Building 7, which came down at 5:20, 7 hours later, and you had all the floors coming down at the same time. It was a classic controlled demolition. When it was over, you had a stack of debris equal to about 12% of the height of the original 47 floors, or 5.5 floors, which is what you have from a collapse. These buildings didn't collapse. They were pulverized. They were turned into very fine dust by the use of a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes, so that there was nothing, nothing in their footprint. There, if it had been a collapse, there should have been about 12% of 110 floors, or about 13.5 floors. I had Father Frank Morales from St. Mark's Episcopal Church, who was a first responder, on my shows twice, and both times Father Frank reported that those buildings were destroyed to or even slightly below ground level, which we can see also in photographic record, because you have, for example, where Building 1 had stood, and you can see there's nothing there, and in the background, you can see this massive pile of debris from Building 7, and yet Building 7 was only 47 floors, while Building 1, the North Tower, was 110. So the debris pile from Building 1 ought to have been staggeringly larger than the debris pile from Building 7, but the opposite turns out to be the case, because they didn't collapse. They were blown apart by very powerful explosives that had to be nuclear. In fact, the U.S. Geological Survey studied dust samples from 35 locations in lower Manhattan and discovered elements that in their correlations and quantities were indicative of nuclear events, including barium, strontium, lithium, lanthanum, tritium, some of which only exist in radioactive forms. So the government's own evidence refutes the government's hypothesis. This was no collapse. These were nuclear engineered events to destroy the Twin Towers to benefit Israel.
I remember hearing, I'd have to check my sources to see the specifics, about a company which had access the weeks following, leading up to 9/11, who were systematically going to different areas of the building to, I forget if they were perhaps laying new data cable or something or other that was being upgraded, and would have had to turn off, it suggested, like security cameras, or have access to whatever areas needed. As far as the theory of the cutter charges, if there were at least that, or perhaps the mini nukes, if these would be mini nukes, or whatever you would be suggesting, whatever would have been planted. Do you remember hearing the story about some company who had been there with specific access, revamping certain parts of the building the weeks leading up to the event?
Oh, sure. In fact, Ace Elevator was conducting what was then described as the largest elevator renovation project in history, which would have given access to the core columns. I mean, these buildings were of a unique design. It was called a tube within a tube. So that you had the massive 47 core columns at the center, and then the 230 external columns, where they were connected by steel trusses, connected at one end to the core columns, at the other to the external steel support columns that were filled with 4 to 8 inches of concrete, where the variance accounted because these trusses had 4-inch deep grooves, V-shaped grooves. So that in some places you'd have 8 inches of concrete and other 4. So that when the buildings were destroyed, you know, it created all this open working area outside of the inner tube before you reach the outer tube. But these were extremely robust buildings. It's very interesting that even Donald Trump, in the aftermath of 9/11, was interviewed by a local TV network. And he explained that the builders who had constructed the Twin Towers were working for him now, and that it was impossible that planes could have caused them to collapse, that something else had to be involved. He actually used the word bombs, meaning explosive devices. He was absolutely correct about that, this is the most truth you got from any prominent figure in the United States at the time, which is why many of us believed that he might turn out to be a 9/11 truth president and reveal what actually happened on 9/11. It may yet come, but most certainly we're disappointed that it hasn't happened yet.
I was curious to discuss a bit of some of these other incidents that you've covered, which seem like staged events, very much for the same gun confiscation agenda, attack on our Second Amendment.
Yes. Yes.
Now, I know we had discussed or tried to touch on the Boston bombing and then Orlando, Dallas, Parkland. I don't know, would you care to mind spending a few minutes on each of these?
Gladly, gladly. No, that's a great idea. In Boston, the police were actually on bullhorns calling out, "This is a drill. This is a drill." The Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities. And then in a second tweet, that one would be set off in 1 minute opposite the library. And 1 minute later, one of these explosions was set off in front of the Boston Public Library. Now, I was an artillery officer in the Marine Corps, and I can tell you these were puff pieces. These were theatrical. I don't believe they were powerful enough to kill anyone unless you were actually sitting on top of them. Now, when the cameras peered in from the smoke, yes, there were bodies lying there with missing arms and legs, but there was no blood. As Lorraine Day, MD, was the head of trauma surgery for San Francisco General Hospital for 25 years, has observed, you cannot have arms and legs blown off by explosives and there to be no blood. The blood only showed up later. I thought it had initially come out of tubes. It actually came out of little orange duffel bags that were fake blood kits. What they did was to use amputee actors. I mean, this was the genius of it. Amputee actors who are already missing their arms and legs. In one case, a fellow named Jeff Bowman, they actually attached a false leg prosthesis with a bone extending to make it look even more horrific. You can actually see a man in a hoodie attaching this false prosthesis. If Jeff Bowman had actually lost his legs during the explosion, he would have been from the bleed out, he would have been unconscious in 1 minute, dead in two. Instead, several minutes later, they put him in a wheelchair, which is the wrong thing to do with a victim with these lower extremity injuries, because then gravity helps to draw out the blood. And they moved him off in a wheelchair. There's a fellow running beside him holding what's supposed to be a makeshift tourniquet. He's a tall guy in a cowboy hat. His name is Carlos Arredondo. A Hollywood producer informed me that he'd actually cast him as an actor in one of his films. He also told me that they use a smoke machine. And when we poured through all of the footage, we found a studio-quality smoke machine. In fact, these explosions were so feeble that they didn't even cut up or tear banners that were in the immediate vicinity of where the second of the explosions took place. So it was all totally fraudulent. This guy named Jeff Bowman actually was an Army lieutenant who lost his legs in Afghanistan, who was recruited for the role. I mean, it was embarrassingly bad. Indeed, the Boston bombing was cracked by the alternative media the day of the event, because they discovered all kinds of footage of this private company Blackwater was actually there on the scene, and that they had planted the bombs. The members of this private army, Kraft International, were wearing khaki trousers, black jackets, black baseball bats, with baseball caps with a skull insignia where the motto of Kraft is, "Violence does solve problems." We have photographs of two of these guys, one wearing a black nylon backpack with a white square on it, moving to the location where one of the bombs exploded. The bomb that exploded was in a black nylon backpack with a white square, and we have other images of him rushing away, no longer wearing the backpack. In fact, the FBI, which did a report about the Boston bombing, reported that both of the bombs that exploded were in black nylon backpacks. It's very interesting, but that the aunt of the Saranov brothers who were accused of the crime explained to me that they'd been photoshopped into the imagery of the Boston Marathon. And I asked how she knew, and she said because Tamerlan, the older brother, is shown clean-shaven, but he actually had a beard. And I asked if she could prove it, and she sent me a photograph of Tamerlan lying in bed with his cat. He had a beard. She sent me a link to a video where he and his younger brother, Zoker, are working out in a gymnasium shortly before the marathon. He had a beard. A friend called him after the marathon, relieved to find they'd been nowhere in the vicinity. They had dinner together. He had a beard. The following day, when they're being pursued, a convenience store footage shows Zoker inside Tamerlan out. He has a beard. He's arrested in Watertown, stripped naked by the police and put into a police car. He has a beard. Then his body shows up shortly thereafter with a huge gash in the side, and he's still got a beard. But the mistake they made when they photoshopped them into the footage is they didn't give them the right backpacks. They both have large, baggy backpacks that aren't at all like the very compact black nylon backpacks in which the bombs were contained. Not only that, but Zoker has a silver-colored or gray-colored backpack, not a black nylon. And Tamerlan has a very large, baggy backpack. It's dark-colored, but it's not at all the same. Such that a retired professor of law by the name of John Remington Graham has submitted an amicus curiae brief in the case to the First Circuit Court explaining how, because the backpacks don't match, that Zoker, who's been convicted of the crime and sentenced to death, cannot possibly have been responsible. So that's the story on the Boston bombing. Orlando's very interesting. As in the case of the school, the club had been closed. The permit for the club had expired 3 years earlier. They'd actually repainted the club from white to black because it was closed. It only had 11 parking spots. The legal occupancy of the club was only 150. If they had over 300 crammed in, as the official account claims, there would have been abandoned vehicles all over the place, but they were not there. They used crisis actors of a very low quality. It was embarrassingly bad. They would eventually put together a completely contrived video inside and out, and the outside footage, for which there's a date timestamp, appears to be authentic, and you don't see any vehicles in the vicinity. It's like the place was abandoned. Then they have videos from inside, and you see what's supposed to be a shooter, but there's no date timestamp. It's all obviously just staged because he's walking around and there aren't any bodies. Well, there would have had to have been bodies all over the place. Not only that, but they claimed that there were no exits and everyone was trapped. Well, if you look at a floor plan of the building, there were like 8 different exits. And you had people like cowboys throwing bodies into pickup trucks to rush them down to the Orlando Emergency Medical Center. You cannot do that with anyone who's wounded or injured. You might aggravate their wounds. You'd be sued and liable if they died, for example. That was all completely phony and contrived. No string of ambulances there, no rush of EMTs, just like at Sandy Hook. Totally fake. The Orlando Emergency Medical Center would later announce that it wasn't going to charge for services rendered. Well, think about it. When's the last time you heard of a hospital not charging for a Band-Aid? They weren't going to charge for services rendered because they didn't render any services and they didn't want to be prosecuted for fraud.
And as far as the people being trapped, I forget how many minutes is documented allegedly that they were the nightclub goers were trapped inside there, and how many people were claimed to be in the body count?
Well, I think it was 50, but I mean, it was all made up. It was all total fantasy. It didn't happen. It was just another BS story, a humongous pile of bull.
Well, how
it's
would
unbelievable.
How would they even be locked in there? That's even suspicious as well, as far as what we know of the incident. Isn't that correct?
I'm telling you, if you look at a floor plan, there were like 8 different exits. If it had been real, there would have been people streaming out of each of the exits.
Wow.
They didn't come out because there weren't any people in there to come out. I mean, the whole thing was totally fake. It's embarrassingly bad. There's a brilliant guy by the name of Harrison Hanks who calls himself the ultimate crisis actor. You got to find his little video. It's about, 10 or 12 minutes long. And he goes through and he fakes all kinds of crisis acting, from a whole bunch of these locations, including Sandy Hook and Boston and Orlando. And you see him in these different roles, and he intersperses it with some of the actual crisis actors on the scene at the time. They are pathetically bad. Harrison Hanks, the ultimate crisis actor. Let me take you to Parkland. Parkland was on St. Valentine's Day, the 14th of February. That actually was a holiday, so they let the students go at 1 p.m. They had 3,500 students they let go at 1 p.m. Only a few dozen stayed back to be student crisis actors for the staged event. They used a cop in a SWAT outfit firing a SIM gun. This fires simulated ammunition, which is made out of beeswax and laundry detergent. It'll create a welt, but it won't penetrate the skin. That's why you had medical miracles like Maddie and Samantha walking around with Band-Aids over their wounds within days. If they'd been hit with AR-15 rounds, which are small caliber but high velocity, they wouldn't be around at all. They'd be dead. They were supposed to have been shot in the stomach, in the chest, in the leg. I'm telling you, these bullets do devastating damage. The reason the sheriff kept the four deputy sheriffs out of the building is they weren't in the loop about what was going on, and they might have, therefore, mistakenly taken out the shooter, not realizing it was just play acting, that it was all fake and fabricated. Then it was all really set up to be the pseudo justification for the March for Our Lives, which would occur on the 24th of March. I mean, look, you got a month and 10 days. I mean, this is hardly enough time to organize a bake sale at a local church. But they had all these acts. They had hundreds of T-shirts of different designs, coffee cups, all this sort of thing. It had been planned well in advance. In fact, in Washington, D.C., if you're going to have an event that closes a roadway, you have to submit your permit process six months in advance. So they were already permitting for the March for Our Lives back in October and September, long before the DNC-sponsored Parkland shooting. Deborah Wasserman Schultz was very worried that because of the Imran Awan, her tech guy scandal, where he was spying on other members of Congress with her authority, that the Democrats might lose as many as 11 seats in the House in Florida alone. So they staged the event to justify what turned out to be a DNC voter registration drive with billions of free publicity in Washington, D.C., in the March for Our Lives with all of these acts. It's very interesting how David Hogg, who appears to have graduated from Redondo Scholes High School in California before he transferred to Parkland to be a spokesman for the students there, did an interview with CBS 6 hours after he spoke during the March for Our Lives and acknowledged how he'd gone home and then had belatedly realized he had to get back to the school, and he rode his bicycle back to the school so he could participate in the fake stage shooting. He didn't put it in those words exactly, but that's exactly what was going on. He talked about getting on his bicycle to ride back to school after school had already been let out at 1 p.m. So that's Parkland, completely outrageous. Las Vegas was on an even more grandiose scale. They actually used a pre-recorded soundtrack of a machine gun firing and American military weapons, which fire in three-shot blasts in the background. Dan Kramer, who's an iTech guy, was the first to realize that the quality of the sound, which you could hear all over Las Vegas, was much too good to have been genuine and bona fide. They used this pre-recorded soundtrack, which they broadcast over the PA system for the concert, in order to affect a background against which they used coordinated special visual effects, such as flashing lights in the middle of the Mandalay Bay on the fourth floor, flashing lights to simulate a machine gun firing, and then on a higher floor, three light blasts to simulate American military firing. Crowds on demand had been recruiting crisis actors for the Las Vegas events for 14 days in advance. I suspect they had seated the crowd of over 20,000 with around 500 crisis actors. No one is shot. It's all completely fake. We have looked at over 30 of the videos. No one is being shot. You can hear lots of sounds of shot, but no one's actually being shot. There's another video where someone steps out in the crowd and starts firing on the crowd, and you can see the muzzle light, but he's using blanks because, once again, no one is shot. Then we had another video where one of the directors of the crisis actors actually got out in front of the camera to have a crisis actor couple redo their scene because it wasn't good enough. We had an American professional military physician write to Paul Craig Roberts about how he'd reviewed the videos of the alleged casualties in the hospital, and none of them were real. They were all fake. That was followed by another trauma doctor from the United States who observed they weren't even connected to the diagnostic equipment such as blood pressure in the hospital. Totally fake. A couple years ago, I lost my balance, and to make sure nothing was wrong, we went down to the urgent care center here. From the moment I entered, they put me on a blood pressure monitor till the moment I got a clean bill of health. The whole time there, I was being monitored, but none of these alleged patients in these hospitals were even on the blood pressure monitors. I had a Facebook friend who called the three closest hospitals concert area and asked if they'd had any admittees with gunshot wounds in the wake of the event. And all three of them replied, no, they had not. And one cheerfully added, I think you're calling about the drill, but no one was shot. It was just a drill. You need to check with the local police. Mona Alexis Prexley actually tracked down the police map for the area, the 24 hours surrounding the concert shooting from like 8 p.m. before the event to 8 p.m. the following day. And while there are about 16 or 20 events recorded, none of them involve any shooting event. They're all really routine, stolen property, burglary, assault and battery, domestic disturbance. There's not a single bona fide shooting event. It was all completely staged. When a local journal wanted to get death certificates from the coroner, he actually closed the coroner's office because he didn't have any. But when the court ordered that he had to produce them, he reached out to six different medical examiners all over the country and put together a bunch of death, medical examination where he struck the file numbers and claimed these were all deaths from Las Vegas. It was all completely phony, completely fake. And now they're even giving out additional benefits for trauma and suffering to the crisis actors, which is hush money, so they won't spill the beans. I'm telling you, these are outrageous actions, and the American people are being played. Absolutely outrageous.
And they're benefiting on a small scale in the immediate with, a lot of security enhancements, procedures for the schools, because you're under the impression that these are real incidents. And a lot of companies are profiting from that industry now. From what I understand, David Hogg's father, and David Hogg, from what I'm told, he was too old to actually be a student there. Nonetheless, his father was invested in a company that would profit greatly from some of the legislation they were trying to push locally for the schools in the wake of the shooting. As far as the Second Amendment, you think they, in the long term, though, also want to attack the Second Amendment with this school shooting agenda, chain of shootings over the years. And it's amazing how more frequently they've occurred, both here in the U.S. and abroad, not always at schools. But, I mean, do you think that it's an attack on the Second Amendment, our gun rights?
Well, of course, absolutely. It's both an attack on the First Amendment and the Second. And that's where Lenny Posner comes in and his attack on me. You see, I'm bringing together these experts and we're blowing each of these cases apart one after another. So they have to cut that out if they're going to take our guns, because if the American people understand they're being played, they'll never give up their guns. In fact, They should never give up their guns. I have frequently observed when they come for our guns, the time has come to use them. Even in New Zealand, where they had the completely phony and fake mosque shootings there, where the videos were so bad that now you can incur a $10,000 fine from even having one of those videos on your desktop because they're so obviously fake, the Kiwis have been unwilling to give up their guns. There are over 1.5 million guns in New Zealand, but only 700 have been turned in, and the Kiwis aren't going to do it. They're not stupid. It turns out that worldwide, there is an inverse relationship between gun ownership and homicides. In other words, the more guns, the fewer homicides. The Democrats are selling us a bill of goods that the more guns, the more gun homicides. But that's absurd. It's completely contrary to the facts. Their minds are made up. They know their policy, which is to disarm America, which is going to be catastrophic if it were to happen. But I don't think Americans are going to be any more willing to give up their guns than our New Zealanders, the Kiwis. And in fact, it turns out that studies have shown the defensive use of guns in America occurs between 500,000 and 3 million times every single year and is saving between 150 and 200,000 American lives every single year. Even if you factor in these fake school shootings, the deaths in schools and public schools have dramatically dropped over the last 50 years. They have dropped, even with the staged phony shootings. And when you take into account the defensive use of guns, you can see it would be complete insanity to give up our guns. You'd be marking hundreds of thousands of Americans to death if you were to adopt these Democratic Party policies.
I was curious to hear your information about Charlottesville. I never really did hear a take on anyone who had researched it enough to find...
Charlottesville has been very frustrating because, as I may have mentioned, I taught at the University of Virginia twice. I thought when we discovered the whole thing was a scam that there were two different cars, both Dodge Challengers, one had a racing stripe, one didn't, one had a sunroof, one didn't, two different alleged drivers. One's this 20-year-old schizophrenic who has thick prescription glasses who's just been convicted of murder, but he wasn't even driving the car. The other was a 32-year-old military guy who commands a battalion of reservists in Ohio. He was actually driving the car. There were two or three different takes. You got one where there's a Dodge Challenger, no other vehicles around. There's another where the Dodge Challenger plows into the back of two vans that have been parked there for about 5 minutes with no occupants in it. Then there's a third where you have a photoshopped image of a stunt driver flying through the air, and you have the Dodge Challenger, and there's a black Toyota pickup beside it. That was on the front page of the New York Times. It turns out Heather Heyer wasn't killed in this. It was all a stage event. She died the following day of a heart attack. Mona Alexis Presley was able to sort it out. But you'll love this. Donna Soto, who played the mother of Heather Heyer, The woman who played the mother of Heather Heyer in Charlottesville also played the mother of one of the teachers at Sandy Hook. I mean, you can't believe how bad it is. And I sent all this stuff to the members of the Department of History at the University of Virginia. There are over 80 members thinking they might care about what actually happened. I sent it to the president. I sent it to the provost and the vice provost. I sent it to members of the city council. I would eventually send it to the prosecutor. I have filed complaints twice with a Virginia bar about this fraud in Charlottesville. This kid had nothing to do with it. It's another completely staged event. And you can get the books on Charlottesville, on Orlando and Dallas, on Boston, on Sandy Hook. Well, Sandy Hook, actually, you can get that one for free. You can get on the moon landing, and that includes, by the way, about the first death of Saddam Hussein and the second death of Osama bin Laden, and even about the Holocaust and the moon book. And I suppose we didn't go to the moon either, which is maybe my favorite book of all of these. It's so rich and varied in its content, and has just appeared in a second edition. And then, of course, you can get the 9/11 book. There's a book on JFK, my fourth book on JFK, Who, How, and Where, Why, Who, How, and Why. There turned out to be 8 shooters for JFK. I mean, it was a real turkey shoot. It's unbelievable. Lee Oswald was actually standing in the doorway when the JFK motorcade came by. There's a completely brilliant book also there by Larry Rivera entitled The JFK Horseman, about the 4 motorcycle escort officers, all of whom confirmed that the driver, William Greer, had pulled the limousine to a halt, to the left and to a halt to make sure JFK would be killed. He'd already been hit twice. He'd been hit once in the back by a shot fired from the top of the county records building by a deputy sheriff by the name of Harry Weatherford. He'd been shot in the throat by a shot fired through the windshield from inside the triple underpass by an Air Force expert named Jack Lawrence using a special weapon he was given by Curtis LeMay, the Air Force chief of staff. After the limousine was pulled to a halt, Jack was hit in the back of the head by a shot fired from the Daltex by an anti-Castro Cuban named Nestor Tony Escadro using a Mannlicher Carcano, the only unsilenced weapon that was used in Dallas, where he fired 3 shots to set up the acoustical impression of only 3 shots having been fired. Jack slumped forward, Jack eased him back up, and he was hit in the right temple by a shot fired from the intersection of the triple underpass and the picket fence by Frank Sturgis, who was a kind of soldier of fortune who may have been the best shot in the world at the time. David W. Mandick, MD, PhD, who the world-leading expert on the medical evidence, now believes Jack was actually hit in the head a third time from the south knoll. And this came as a great surprise to me, but I've now seen 2 photographs. There's only a single tree over there, but I've seen 2 photographs, one in the hands of Rick Rosso, the other Ed Tatro, 2 different photographs of the shooter with a rifle gumming up behind the tree there. Lyndon Johnson's own personal hitman was in the book depository firing at John Connally in the mistaken belief that it was the liberal Texas senator that Lyndon tried to get in place of Connally, who was his friend. They had a huge argument that morning where Jack overrode Ralph Yarborough, where Jack overrode Lyndon's demand that Yarborough ride, explained that the chief executive of the state should ride with the chief executive of the United States. And because John Connally was also hit, it obfuscated the politics. But this was a Lyndon Johnson operation from beginning to end. He had forced himself on the ticket in L.A. in 1960. Jack had already invited Stuart Symington of Missouri to be his running mate. When Bobby went by the Johnson suite to make a pro forma offer for him to run, never imagining Lyndon would have the least interest, he jumped on it. He threatened to expose that Jack had Addison's disease and wasn't expected to live a long, healthy life, that he'd had paramours with beautiful women, including a spy for his Germany, information he got from J. Edgar Hoover, and that if he were not on the ticket, then any legislative proposal set down by the White House would be dead on arrival, because in his position as a powerful majority leader, he'd make sure they were bottled up. When one of Lyndon's wealthy backers learned that he was going to be on the ticket with JFK, he burst into the Johnson suite cursing and swearing, because now Lyndon was going to help JFK become elected. Bobby Baker took him into a bedroom and explained what they had in mind. He came out all smiles and said he thought that was an excellent plan. Bobby Baker would later declare that JFK would not live out his first term and that he would die a violent death. Lyndon Johnson would send his chief administrative assistant, Cliff Carter, down to Dallas to make sure all the arrangements were in place for the assassination.
Wow, so before JFK even became president, this assassination was planned?
No. You know, Lyndon was running for president, too, if he'd become elected, you know, but he wasn't. Jack eclipsed him. Jack ran a better campaign. So the fallback was for him to be, you know, force himself on the ticket of vice president and take out Jack and become president, which is exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm. I just know, I mean, he did have a lot of bold moves when he was president. He issued his own greenback, which was not based on fiat currency, from what I understand. And then he was tough against Israel attaining nuclear weapons as well. Isn't that correct?
Yes, 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 absolutely. It was at loggerheads with David Ben-Gurion, who was the first PM and a founder of Israel. And Ben-Gurion appears to have resigned in disgust and instructed the Mossad to participate in the assassination of JFK. He'd antagonized the military because he'd not invaded Cuba, contrary to the unanimous recommendation. He'd signed an above-ground test ban treaty with the Soviet Union, contrary to the unanimous opposition, and now he was going to pull our forces out of Vietnam, which the Joint Chiefs thought was the last straw, that he'd become an obstacle instead of a solution to dealing with the expansion of international communism. The CIA was upset because he was threatening to shatter the agency into 1,000 pieces after it pulled a bait and switch over Cuba. The mafia was upset because Bobby was cracking down on organized crime, making more indictments and arrests than ever before in American history. The Texas oilmen were upset because Jack was going to cut the oil depletion allowance, a massive tax write-off they got on the specious grounds that by pumping oil out of the ground, since it was a finite resource, they were putting themselves out of business. The banksters were upset because, as you observe, he had directed the Department of Treasury to print United States notes, believing it was absurd for the government to pay a private consortium of banks to print the currency of the United States and pay interest. Most of the so-called national debt is interest to these bankers for printing the currency of the United States, which is absolutely unnecessary, because the Department of the Treasury can print its own currency and doesn't owe any interest to anybody. Jack had hundreds of millions of United States notes published. I'm hopeful Donald Trump may do something of the same, because it looks as though there's going to be a currency exchange in the works here in the very near future. So those are some of the key elements that entered into the assassination. Each of the groups seemed to have put up their own shooter. The anti-Castro Cubans, of course, thought he'd betrayed them at the Bay of Pigs. Actually, he had not. It turns out that the CIA had learned the Soviets knew the date of the invasion, that they'd informed Fidel Castro. So everyone knew that we were coming, except for the commander-in-chief. No doubt Jack would have called it off had he only known the truth of the matter. But they tried to parlay him as an inexperienced president into sending in the Marines or taking egg on their face. And they were very surprised when he took egg on their face. He wound up removing two of the deputy directors of the CIA, Richard Bissell and Charles Campbell, who were icons of the agency. Campbell was a lieutenant general in the Air Force, and he was the brother of the mayor of Dallas, Earl Campbell, who had joined the CIA in 1956, we've learned from the latest revelations. Larry Rivera, by the way, has done absolutely spectacular work. I highly recommend his book, also at Moonrock Books, on the Four Horsemen. That's an absolutely fabulous book.
Okay. And we discussed Kennedy's feelings toward Israel, and it seems like his assassination, therefore, just like a lot of major events or wars, occurred because a number of different powers agreed on wanting to get him out of the picture. And that was what it
took. Well, each of these elements had their own shooter. So they were like tied together in a blood oath. You had a Dallas deputy sheriff who shot him from the top of the county records building. You had an Air Force expert from inside the triple underpass. You had an anti-Castro Cuban from the Dow Techs. You had a Dallas police officer on the grassy knoll who had to pull his shot because he would have injured Jackie, and they were under strict instructions that Jackie should not be shot. There was a guy who worked for the Bronfman, who was from a Toronto crime family who appears to have been representing Israel, who is in the vicinity of the pergola. I mean, this just turns out to be a really complicated, murder mystery, untangling which has been a preoccupation of mine for now since 1992. So you can see we have shattered the cover-up. We discovered they altered the x-rays to conceal a fist-sized blowout to the back of the head, that the brain shown in diagrams and photographs in the National Archives isn't even the brain of JFK. that they altered the Zapruder film. The original would have had about 1,000 frames. The present only had 487. They took out about 100 turning from Houston onto Main, and then 400 more after the limousine was brought to a halt, since it was such an obvious indication of Secret Service complicity. So there's, you know, we have nailed these things down in minute detail, and I just recommend, if you want to know the truth, or as close to the truth as we have been able to establish, and I guarantee you, what we have there is 99% plus accurate, go to Moonrock Books and check them out. Richard, I can't thank you enough for featuring me tonight. This has been a real pleasure.
Absolutely. We didn't get a chance to get to Iran, but that could definitely be next time. But, I mean, it should be clear.
Well, let me just add that Rand Paul shot golf with Donald Trump this weekend, and it's just been announced today. This is the latest news that he's Donald Trump's emissary to Iran. He's going to reduce tensions with Iran. This is a very welcome development. Rand Paul is one of the few figures in Congress for whom I have great admiration. Another, incidentally, is Tulsi Gabbard. Rand is in the Senate. Tulsi is in the House. They're both outstanding. I dare say, however, the Democrats are going to find Michelle Obama is offered up as a solution to their problem to run for president. And you already know what I have to tell you about her.
Yes, certainly do. Well, it was a pleasure. And thank you so much for your time, sir. We'll definitely love to do this again in future. And I'll definitely spread the word with this archive as much as possible. Get more people out there to know the truth. And I hope your case turns in your favor, sir.
Well, we'll see. It's going to be a test of the appeals court, but the evidence is there. I think it isn't going to be a close call. If they accept my appeal, I believe there are going to be very significant consequences. And Richard, I thank you on all counts. Wonderful of you to have me back again, and it's a real pleasure to participate in these programs.
Oh, wonderful. Well, have a great night, sir, and I'd love to do this again. Cheers.
We'll do it. We'll do it again, Richard. Thank you so much. Cheers.
And good night to all the listeners as well. We will speak again soon. And until then, transcend the construct. Regards.